is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The president of Ukraine in London, Westminster Hall, to the gathered MPs. 2 years ago, I left Parliament thanking you for the delicious English tea. Today, I will leave Parliament thanking all of you in advance for powerful English planes. In response, the Prime Minister's spokesperson later said, "Of course, we have been discussing fighter combat aircrafts today. Nothing is off the table." From London. The detail here is that President Zelensky, leaving London, travels to Paris to the Elysee Palace to meet not only with President of France, Emmanuel Macron, but the Chancellor of Germany, Olaf Scholz. I welcome Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, CBS News, visiting professor at Dickinson College, as well as CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. Jeff, last week it was Germany said yes to the main battle tank. Other main battle tanks are in train, including the M1A Abrams. This week, it's nothing is off the table for warplanes. We are building larger and larger weapon systems. I don't know where this is going, but right now, do you measure that cycle that you highlighted last week, the denial, the exception, the grudging acknowledgement, and then finally the free flow of weapons will continue, and that warplanes, certainly offensive weapons, are in the mix for Ukraine?
Well, good to you, John. I certainly think so. This is being played out over and over again. And the Brits, I would argue, to their credit, have been at the forefront. I mean, don't forget, the Brits were the first to pledge modern battle tanks when they offered the Challenger. That was followed by the Germans, of course, and the United States. Last year, the Brits were the first European country to equip Ukraine with anti-tank missiles. And we know the Brits have been very, very forward-leaning in the training of Ukrainian soldiers on their territory. There are estimates they have now trained over 10,000 Ukrainians and may train another 20,000 or more as the months ahead. So Britain has been in the forefront of countries willing to provide the Ukrainians what they require. And now we're talking about combat aircraft. And it would also strike me, though, Mr. Sunak, it seemed to me, didn't quite promise the actual delivery of a number of planes. He did say we'll begin the actual training of pilots. Well, that's going a pretty far forward. And I also told, by talking to Air Force friends, that frankly, if you take a Ukrainian pilot who's experienced on a Ukrainian high-performance aircraft, probably can train him up to fly a advanced Western aircraft in probably a couple of months, maybe 4 months at tops. So a fairly short training period if you were trying to transition from perhaps flying a MiG to flying a more advanced aircraft provided by a Western country.
Here's the puzzle, Jeff. The combat is active in Donbass. The threat of a Russian offensive has been on the front pages for weeks. We don't know what's coming. We do know that that threat is repeated not only by Kyiv, but by London, by other capitals, the expectation of something large coming. There is not 4 months in that formula. There's not even 2 months. There could be weeks. So right now, what is the conversation about warplanes? A long war? Post-war? Where is this going? How do we understand what a warplane can do, let's see, in June that is needed now?
Well, I think the hope may be, John, of course, that the promise of these weapon systems' future may over time give Russia some pause on their offensive, even before those weapons are actually involved in aerial combat. And that may be hope as opposed to a method. That's certainly part and parcel of that. But it clearly suggests, and you rightfully point out, that we're talking several months down the road here. Same is true for the delivery of the mass majority of the tanks we're talking about. By the colleagues I've spoken with, the delivery of the M1A1 Abrams tank probably won't arrive for another 6 to 8 months. Even the Leo 3s, probably not until Easter at the earliest, if not a little bit later. So if the Russians are, in fact, as we believe, either beginning or planning very shortly to begin an all-out offensive in the Luhansk Donbass region, these promises of weapon systems are not going to make any immediate difference on the battlefield. The Ukrainians are going to have to pretty much fight it out with what they have on hand, hopefully resupplied by a lot of ammunition, and then look. In fact, some have suggested they should look to later in the springtime for their own counteroffensive when the ground dries up after the spring thaw and all the mud and those weapons are in place.
History, World War One, right before. The story is who started the war and why. It's never been completely answered, but there is this observation. Germany, Berlin at the time, the Kaiser and his generals believed that Russia, given time, would overwhelm Germany manufacturing armaments and mobilizing an army because the Russian manufacturing base was cooking at the time. Combined with France and Britain as an ally, Germany felt surrounded, therefore launched the war. Now, that's World War One. Is that something that you've seen in other histories? You've done the history of war in detail. It's been your life's work. You launch because you're on the back foot, not on the front foot.
I think that's clearly very true. I mean, many people said even in Britain, there was a concern about getting, there was going to be a war. Do it sooner rather than later because of a concern of German battleship construction. And people would do analysis that said in 5 or 10 years, by the middle of the 1920s or later, the German Navy would outstrip the British Navy. That probably was apocryphal, but that's what they said. Certainly the Japanese in the Pacific War were very much spurred forward by the fact that in 1940, Franklin Roosevelt will move the Pacific Fleet to Pearl Harbor and also begin instituting sanctions against the Japanese. And the Japanese, as they felt more and more encroached upon, after the war, when interviewed, many of senior Japanese said, once the Americans moved the fleet to Pearl Harbor, we, in fact, felt war was inevitable.
So what we have here is the possibility that the, if you want peace, prepare for war, could be a trigger. Now, let's go to the battlefield. The battlefield remains mixed. Bakhmut remains a target, the mystery of this target, but it continues. Every other day, there's a declaration that it's cut off, surrounded, surrendered, and it doesn't quite. I see no change in the battlefield for weeks now. Does that tell us anything, Jeff?
Yeah, no significant change, at least, in success, if the Russians are having any, is measured in yards and not in miles. There are also reports that Russians in the last couple of days have had some of the most grievous days of this entire war in terms of casualties. And now everyone seems to agree the Russians have probably suffered over 200,000 casualties since the war began about a year ago, probably 50,000 or more dead, 100,000 to 150,000 wounded, captured, missing, deserted, et cetera. So Bakhmut becomes that sort of meat grinder where they're using almost human wave attacks in an effort to overwhelm this particular town, which my read examining the map does not have tremendous military significance whatsoever, but I think has taken on political significance that the Russians desire some sort of a victory they can point to as they pass this upcoming anniversary at the end of the month. And it also bespeaks, I think, the friction that's ongoing still between the Russian military and the Wagner group commanded by Yevgeny Prigozhin, because Prigozhin's troops, the Wagner group, were at the forefront of this fighting, may have suffered horrific casualties. And Wagner, Prigozhin, actually complained that the reason they were not successful was because they had gotten insufficient support from the Russian government and the Russian army, showing a division, if you will, between those two military entities, both serving Moscow.
The war in Europe and State of the Union. You underlined to me, Jeff, that there was a moment that looked to unite the parties and erase the enmity in Washington. How did you read the standing ovation to our president?
Well, I think Mr. Biden's speech at that particular part, and obviously the speech was not to dwell on foreign policy. There was very little about foreign policy in the entire speech for about an hour and 15 minutes. But he said, you know, that we have stood the test and called this particular war a test for the ages and a test for America. And then after he'd acknowledged the Ukrainian ambassador in the gallery, the president, looking directly at her, said, and I quote, "We will stand with you as long as it takes." As I was watching that for CBS News, what struck me then is both sides of the aisle largely applauded, to include the Speaker of the House, Mr. McCarthy, all applauded, suggesting at least for the moment there is bipartisan support for Ukraine. That seems to be what polls suggest across the country. But there's a real concern, and you and I have talked about it, John, is will the American people and therefore the representatives continue to support Ukraine if this war goes on for an almost indefinite period of time? I noticed, for example, as well, John, like the second hearing by the House Armed Services Committee of the new schedule instituted by the new Congress focused on the military-industrial complex, particularly concerned about, do we, in the light of the war in Ukraine, have the ability to produce the sufficient munitions, javelins, stingers, 155 projectiles, HIMARS rockets that modern warfare require?
Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, CBS News, visiting professor at Dickinson College, the CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. The State of the Union, also the split screen of 21st century, Europe at war and Asia looking looming threatening. When we come back, the Asia screen. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Beckman.